אני מאמין באמונה שלמה. I believe with complete, perfect faith, Shabiris Baruch Shemai, that Hashem, the Creator, blessed be His name. Is Gimel Tev L'Shem Remitveisav rewards the those who follow His commandments, Umanish Levri Mitveisav, and punishes those who violate His commandments. Amongst the questions that we began to answer last week was, what is the reward? We have yet to define what is the punishment for violating the mitzvahs. Another thing I think that's worthwhile exploring is, why is it necessary, even according to this, the explanation that we gave, that there has to be a negative and a positive? Why can't there be a neutral and positive? In other words, the whole objective is the fact that Hashem wants to create a world in which a person can choose a relationship with Him and allow Hashem to bestow upon him, to confer upon him the greatest possible bracha. So why can't those be the choices? One would be the choice of a person electing to have this very intimate relationship with the Kodesh Baruch. And the other choice would be, it's parva, it's lukewarm, it's not necessarily choosing pain and suffering or punishment. Why do we have to have the other side? If the whole idea is choice, why do we need the other side? And then finally, why is it that we don't have the reward and punishment of the world to come? Why is that not mentioned in the Torah? It seems to be that's a very important facet of what we believe. So let's just very, very quickly just run back over what we said in terms of reward. We explained that the essence of the reward, the substance of the reward, is a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the Almighty is the perfect goodness. He's the source of all shleimus, of all perfection, of the quintessential strengths and wisdom and so on. And that to be able, for us to be able to have an intimate relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu means to be able to access all of this perfection. Therein we stated that every mitzvah, every expression of a person's desire to participate actively, to affirm Torah mitzvahs, is really a statement which reads, Hashem, I want a relationship with you, I want to be close to you, I want to attach myself to you, I want to destroy the barriers which separate me from you, which come between us. And that in response to that statement, that Hashem does, in fact, invest us with a higher level of spiritual perfection, spiritual excellence, thereby simultaneously allowing us to step closer towards Him. We also described the fact that every act which is consistent with Hashem Yisbarach's will is one which opens the arteries of divine emanation which deliver Hashem's perfect goodness to the world, so that it reaches this world undiminished and unobstructed in its fullest possible strength, and as such, the entire universe reverberates to this and resonates with this glow, with this goodness. We also describe the fact that a human being is creative, and that when he does something which is according to Hashem's Ratzon, then the person creates thereby a very powerful force of goodness, a very positive kind of energy, whether we call it a malach, or a saneger, a champion, whatever the case is, it is the creation of a force which then stands us personally in good stead, as well as the context in which we live. And with this explanation, we were able to resolve these two divergent points of view, namely the one which sees reward and punishment as being something which comes directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu on a moment-to-moment basis in response to what we do, a point of view which seems to be consistent with the Ramban, one which is very strongly advocated by Rav Weinberg in his book on the fundamentals of faith, and the other position, which is the position of the Shalar HaKadosh, the position of Rabbi Avin Gavin, Avin the HaKadosh, in which a person essentially, that the Almighty has programmed the universe, that when a person does something good, that they become the source of their own reward, that good act becomes something in which there inheres a great deal of bracha, and with our good deed, we automatically provide for the emanation from that good deed to then be a source of blessing for us. So that's kind of an almost automatic kind of a mechanistic view of reward and punishment, with which Weinberg argues is really not the kind of thing which will either hold us accountable or which will move us, because it doesn't have the power to do so. And we propose that these two points of view really coalesce in the fact that we really are the architects and the authors of our own bracha, by virtue of the fact that everything that we do does in fact result in depending on how we do it, the kind of kavona and the kind of preparation, the kind of purity of heart, the kind of yearning that it expresses, that's the way in which it carries us, but that having provided for our progress, having provided for our elevation, that the goal is, and the result is a personal relationship. So there is both the more mechanistic, the more programmed view, in which there is a direct cause and effect relationship between the good or the bad that we do and the results thereof, and the fact that the results thereof are personal. They're not some sterile kind of reward which is divorced from Hashem Yisbarach. Having said that, we can then see that punishment is almost going to be a mirror inversion of what we saw in reward. That just as there were three different points of reference in reward, namely, when a person does something good, that they open the conduits and the highways of hashpois, teves, of divine emanations of goodness and blessing to this world. Similarly, when a person does something which violates the Ratzon of Hashem, they obstruct those systems of delivery and divert the energy to the forces of evil. So it doesn't reach this world in a positive form. It doesn't reach this world in a beneficial form. It reaches this world in a very destructive form, because it now enters the world through the aegis of evil. Second of all, just as when a person does something good, they create something positive, when a person does something which is a violation of Torah, which is a violation of Hashem's Ratzon, a person creates a destructive agent, a malevolent, a demonic presence enters the world. We pollute our world with these forces of darkness. And we then really stand as the objects of the prosecution of those forces which we ourselves created. Finally, we have to realize that just as when we do good, we define ourselves in a more excellent way, when we violate Torah and mitzvahs, we invest ourselves with imperfection, with distortion, with flaws and faults. We blemish ourselves so that we now find ourselves mutilated and wounded by the acts which we've done. We can't see these kinds of things. Hashem Yisburach can see them. People who have very holy eyes, the luminaries, many of the luminaries of our people, were able to look into the soul of a person, were able to see the ways in which people have injured themselves or have maimed themselves, and were able to prescribe ways of people being able to heal these things. But we strangle ourselves. We harm ourselves by doing acts of which are inconsistent with, or which are a violation, a transgression of Torah. Now, one of the reasons that this is so, one of the reasons that there is no neutral, is because when we understand what we're talking about, we can see that we only have one of two choices. We either choose a relationship with God, or we choose a relationship not with God. Those are the only two choices. If we choose a relationship with Hashem, then we expose ourselves to all of the merit, all of the value, all of the virtue, all of the great things that we described. The only other choice is not with God. There is no middle ground here. If you make a choice which is not with God, in effect, what we're stating when we're doing that is that we're making the following case. I know, even though a person may not be so completely informed, but somewhere there is this basic understanding. I know that in order for me to exist, that I must draw upon some force which sustains me. Now, if I do not turn to the legitimate source which sustains me, I must be turning to some other force. A person does not exist by virtue of his own. We're not self-sustaining. When a person makes the implicit statement, I do not seek a connection with Hashem, the source of goodness and perfection, they are making the statement, I seek a relationship with a source of sustenance, of nurturing, which is an alternative to Hashem. I don't submit to, elect to have a relationship with Hashem. So I choose to have a relationship with what? Well, myself, maybe. But what we're saying is that I'm choosing to have a relationship with something other than Hashem. There's no such thing as saying I choose not to have a relationship with anyone. There's no such position. To state I choose to have not to have a relationship with anyone is to state I'm having a relationship with myself. I'm having a relationship with something independent of, separate and distinct of Hashem. Whatever that choice is, whether it's ourselves or whether it's an active choice for evil. What we are making a choice for is something which is finite, something which is limited, something which is imperfect, something which does not provide for all of the things which inhere within Hashem, such as wisdom and strength and goodness and all of those things. It therefore represents, since there are only these two choices, we have to recognize that there are only, as it were, that we only have one of two mates here. Either a person chooses to be intimate with Hashem, or a person chooses to be intimate with whatever is the alternative to Hashem. And that is a step. That's not a neutral position. It is a step for, it's a decision for something other than Hashem. And that's a step into a world of illusion, a world of dissimulation. It's this Alma de Shikra. It's a world of falsehood. And we have to recognize that when we choose a relationship other than that which is one with Hashem, that Hashem, in effect, respects that decision and removes his providence from us. You don't want is nisht. V'histarti ponai mehem, and I will conceal my face from them. V'ha'yulechel, and they will be consumed by these other forces of mitzvahu, rois, rabbis, mitzvahs, as the pasuk attests, and then they will be discovered by, they will be come upon, fallen upon by all kinds of great evils and tzaras. So here's what happens. By virtue of the fact that a person violates Hashem's will, They create all of this distortion in the paths of Hashem's sustaining the world. That sustenance which ordinarily would flow to the world and brighten the world and warm the world and carry the world to greater excellence now comes under the jurisdiction of, under the aegis of a force which Hashem created to provide a legitimate alternative. In other words, if there's going to be choice, there has to be an alternative, an option which is equally inviting, equally exciting as that which Hashem promises. Otherwise, where is the even-handedness? Where is the bechira? That vendor, if you will, of gratification, which presents itself with a power that appears to be on an equal plane with Hashem, is something that we call ra. We call that evil. That alliance is a choice which, as we indicated, Hashem Yisburach, the Almighty, respects, and as such, we have now asked Hashem to let us be governed under a different sovereign, and Hashem steps away from us, and we then become subject to. We then become the heirs to a world which we filled with destructive and malevolent forces, which we ourselves polluted and corrupted. So to use one of the parables or one of the metaphors which we used last week, a person over here, when they make the kind of choices that they do, rather than move towards the warmest possible climate where they can be healed by and embraced by the sun, they choose to move deeper into the colder climate. They put on yet additional layers. And we invest within ourselves a lenses which increasingly distort our ability to process the world in a in an undistorted way. We bring all kinds of barriers and walls between ourselves and the source of all goodness. And as such, the level of pain to which we actively subject ourselves is a result of our choice. We have the additional force of having created these malevolent agencies. We've committed wrongdoing, and our wicked, our immoral, our sinful acts have brought into being these forces of kategoria, these forces of prosecution, these machablim. In the past, we've spoken about the fact that since what we have created is evil, that we must recognize that this evil is perfectly evil. And rather than being grateful for its existence to its author and its creator, namely ourselves, and seeking to spare us and inflict its fury elsewhere, it turns on us because the greatest possible evil is that which does not respect its source. And therefore, we become the prime objects, we become the prime victims of our own evil, because evil turns on us. One of the interesting points of reference over here is the fact that even in the fact that the Rebbeinu Shlalem has allowed for the fact that evil will turn upon us, that we will suffer the consequences of our own wrongdoing, in other words, that we are going to suffer by our own hand. The executioner will be one that we have created. The tormentor will be someone who bears our features, who speaks in our voice, because we are its progenitors. That even in the process of creating free will and bechira and choice, in bringing about this capacity to create evil and to be subjected to that evil, and in the long run for us to be judged and if necessary to be punished in whatever we'll call it Gehenna, purgatory, hell, whatever the case is, that somewhere after our existence that we are going to be judged, and if our verdict is not as we would optimally wish, that we're going to suffer some unspeakable kinds of punishment. We have to recognize that even in all of this, that there is an ultimate kindness and compassion. The reality should be that when a person commits a wrong, that there should be no road of return. There should be no rectification. There should be no absolution here. But the Ribbono Shel Olam, in his perfect kindness, created the possibility that in being exposed to our own wrongdoing, in being matzdik esadin, in recognizing with the vision which will be available to us at some point, and if not in this world and in the next, that the Almighty's judgment is just, that we have chosen wrongly, and that we deserve what is meted out to us, that in either becoming the victims of our own wrongdoing, in other words, that the evil turns against us, or in having the Einshe Gehinim, the punishment of Gehinim, exacted from us, that the Almighty has provided, that will then purge us, that it will cleanse us from the mutilation and all of the blemishes that we have brought upon ourselves. So in creating that entire system, the master of the world has really enabled us to reclaim our integrity, so that we can then once again entertain some kind of a positive relationship with Hashem. We have to recognize that when we speak about something such as the suffering in Gehinnom, in this purgatory, that every act which we have done selfishly, every act which we have done in self-indulgence, every violation of Torah which we have done in transgression of Hashem's will, that those, in much the same way that a good deed becomes part of our excellence, and the wrongdoing becomes a predicate of our being. It's not external to us. It's not like we wear it as one does a glove. It becomes part of us. It clouds our vision. It distorts our judgment, and becomes an integral part of our what we have defined ourselves. That in much the same way that an amputation is painful because it means removing something which has become one with us, that in an identical way, that when the purging that takes place in Gehinnom wants to restore our integrity, wants to rehabilitate us, in excising, in removing this part of us, there's an amputation taking place. And it's that excision, it's that removal of something that we have made one with us, which in fact provides this unspeakable pain and torture which is part of the Ein Sheh Gehinnom. So once again, it's a direct and measure for measure response to what we have done. We have invested within ourselves, we've defined ourselves with this mutilation, and the only way in which it can come out is by some sort of an act of excision, which in removing something from us, which is part of us, is something which generates a level of anguish, of pain, of what have you, agony, that allows for our restoration to once again to a state of being whole. We are then left with our integrity. In other words, this is it's almost as though we grafted something upon ourselves, and that this graft
is removed.
So we are then left complete once again. We're then left intact. Now, before we said, in defense of reward, that reward was a relationship with Hashem. That then introduced Hashem's personal intervention in such a way that even though a person may be the direct cause of his own good, but nonetheless, that good is Hashem. So we were able to resolve the disparity between these two positions to show that they coalesce in a certain sense by virtue of the fact that the reward is a relationship with Hashem. It's not something divided, separate, or distant from Hashem. It's not something mechanistic, and then we have nothing. But what about with evil? If we have a mechanistic view of the fact that, okay, we did something wrong, that wrong will turn upon us, and in its pain will compensate for having absorbed within us the corruptive, the harmful influences. But there it's possible to say, well then, but that's detached from Hashem. Hashem is not involved in that. The good, Hashem is the good. Hashem is the reward. But is then Hashem detached from our punishment such that we are kind of automatically subjected to all of these different forces of compensation and justice? Now, I think we have to recognize that even here, the hand of Hashem is very, very directly involved, even according to those definitions that make those acts one of cause and effect by dint of our own actions. The Ramak, Moshe Kardaviro, in his Tema Devera, explains what the words Nisei Ovein mean. We say that Hashem bears iniquity. So what does that mean? So the Ramak explains, here's what it means. He says that when a person does an avera, when a person commits a transgression, he violates the Torah, the Ratzon of Hashem, that he thereby creates this malevolent force. There is now some new agency in the universe which wasn't here before. If at that moment, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu so decreed, and as it should ordinarily take place, you know, you have this Maimon Chazal. It's one of the agadic treatments of what takes place upon wrongdoing. Wisdom was asked what should be the fate of the sinner. Prophecy was asked what should be the fate of the sinner. So one said, Nefesh HaChatas Tamos. The nerve, the audacity of someone to defy the author of the universe, the creator's will. Person who sins must die. The other said, let the wrongdoing which they have done turn upon them. Now, those are two completely legitimate, very compelling kinds of responses. It is an absolutely indescribable act of audacity, effrontery, for someone to defy the will of the maker of the world. It's craziness. And if a person does so, since the Almighty is the giver of life, they deserve to die. There's no defense. Person is a microscopic little speck and stands up to the infinite creator. It's nuts. It deserves to die. Or the wrongdoing which he has done should be allowed to turn upon him and exact its price. So the Ramak explains that the Almighty in his infinite compassion stays the hand of that being which we have created, does not allow that being to turn upon us immediately in the greatest majority of cases. Does not allow evil to turn upon us. We've created something malevolent. Hashem says, no, you can't turn upon your maker, the evildoer. But in doing so, the Almighty has no choice. On the one hand, because he is ultimately fair, absolutely just, and there is this malevolent universe, this malevolent presence. What is he going to do with it? He can't dismiss it. He can't erase it. It's not just. So what the Almighty does is the Almighty says, you know what? Don't do anything. I'll sustain you. The Almighty sustains our evil because we have created evil. And there are now all of these demonic, malevolent, evil forces. How do they live? Who feeds them? Who sustains them? Who nourishes them? Hashem does. So Hashem is noisei oven. He carries our sin. It's on Hashem's budget.
Rabbi, how does this work exactly, that these forces come into being? Are they there at bay waiting to be formed? Or because we can't say that we're actually creating it from nothing.
Yeah, we create them. Whatever. I'm not sure exactly how it takes place, but they're not. We create them, body and soul. The act itself creates the, as it were, the configuration of this evil malach.
It didn't exist before.
No, it did not exist
in any form. I mean, how can we do
nothing?
How can we create something from
nothing? We're Yetzirah Elohim. That's one of the forces that we are. We're created. B'demus Yetzirahinu. One of the things that we can do is we can create. So however this place takes place, the act itself creates the goof, so to speak, of this malach, and the way in which we did it, whether we did it with a great deal of premeditation and intent, whether we did it with a great amount of defiance of Hashem Yisburach, or whatever the circumstances are. The soul of the spirit of this malach comes from the emotional components and the intellectual components that were present when we did the sever. The Rav Zisha of Anapola once said, I've seen, he says, the malachim that are created by the mitzvahs, which Jews do. He said they're very robust, very healthy looking. He says when a Jew does a mitzvah, he does it with a full heart. He does it joyfully. Does it with a great deal of integrity. That's really what a Jew wants to do. He says when a Jew does an aver, there's no such thing as a Jew doing an aver with a full heart. So he says if you looked at the malachim, which Jews create with their averus, he says you'd see a group of cripples like you never saw before in your life. He says they're handicapped, they're blind, they're deaf, they limp. He says they walk around with all kinds of broken limbs. He says a Jew never creates a malach which is a healthy looking malach from his averus. There's something missing. He says that you just doesn't do an avera with a full heart.
Hashem sustains them for what purpose?
Hashem sustains them.
Destroy them.
Right. Now, Hashem, when he stays the hand of evil and sustains them, these agencies of evil which we ourselves create, Hashem sustains them in the hope and the anticipation that we will at some point do tshuva. And the level and the quality of our tshuva will in one way either diffuse, destroy, or dismember this presence that we have created. Until such time, he is nisei oven. Until such time as he... Now, at some point, the Rebbeinu Shnayla may conclude that we show no signs of remorse, that we show no promise of growing towards a sensitivity which would lead us to ourselves dismantle this force. Whatever the case, there is a constant balance, a constant judgment, which is going on, kaviyochel, before the divine throne for each one of us, wherein the Almighty is making a decision whether or not he should carry all of our personnel, the wicked personnel that we have created, whether he should continue to carry them on his balance sheet, whether they should be part of this workforce that he is sustaining. Because those forces of sustenance diminish the forces that are funneled to this world. And at some point, the Almighty may decide, now he may decide to release some of them, all of them, to release none of them, and to wait until such time as we will pass from this world and we will stand before the tribunal of justice, and at that point we will be confronted by all of those malachi chabala who look the same as ourselves, who speak with our voice, who indict us with our wrongdoing in ways that cannot be which cannot be challenged. So even in those instances in which we speak about mechanistically that we ourselves are the sources of, we are the creators of our own wrongdoing, the Almighty is constantly involved on a personal level. There's a very, very delicate balance taking place every moment. Should I continue to stay their hand? Should I continue to be a Nisayel? Should I release it? And if I do release it, under what circumstances and so on? There's a constant involvement. So even when you take the extreme position, when you take a position of the Shalak, or if you take a position in which, or the Avedis HaKadosh, that a person is the author of his own good and the author of his own evil, in the sense of reward and punishment, the person is the author of his own punishment, even so, it's not mechanistic, automatic, devoid of the divine intervention. The Rebbeinu Shlomo is constantly involved. And the same thing is true when we're doing good. The Almighty may decide that those beneficial forces that we've created, rather for them to intervene immediately on our behalf, in ways which would result in some great stroke of good fortune for us, what have you, the Almighty may decide that that is not the best thing for us, that we need to confront other challenges and may stay that reward for a later time. So whether we are talking about reward or we are talking about punishment, regardless of whether we see every single act as being directly reacted to on a act-by-act basis by Kodesh Baruch Hu, who's going to say, well, this is how I will reward it, this is how I will punish it, or whether we're dealing with the position which says that every act that we do creates good fortune, creates forces of blessing, and that every immoral, every non-Torah, every violation of Torah creates a destructive force, and we ourselves are the author, it is never free of the constant intervention of Hashem Yisbarach, what takes place. We now need to look at why don't we find the hereafter, the reward and punishment of Olam Haba in the Torah. Well, it seems to me that something which is of such paramount importance that it should be in the Torah. Let me tell you some of the answers which are brought in the Sfarim. The Rambam, Maimonides, says that the masses can't deal with something so abstract. That the Torah promises only this worldly reward because everybody can react to it. Everybody, there's a Tzav HaShem over here, there's a common denominator, that even the simplest, even the most unlettered, even the most unsophisticated person understands this worldly kinds of blessings, and therefore the Torah speaks to us across the board and says, if you observe my commandments, my statutes, and so on, then I will provide the rain in its time and all of these things. Whereas, if you violate my will, then all of these punishments will befall the wrongdoer and so on. Because those are things that everybody understands and counts on. The fact that the more sophisticated, the wiser person will understand that this is hardly the appropriate reward for aligning oneself with the will of an infinite being, and that everyone will who pursues a course of learning will arrive at this the proper conclusion on their own. So that the Torah only speaks in a way which speaks to everyone equally. Nachmanides, the Ramban, says that by definition, that the spiritual is something which is devoid of, which is not restricted by the physical forces. So we know that things which are physical are mortal, they're finite, that they're subject to all kinds of pain and suffering, whereas the spirit, the neshama, is really an otherworldly kind of thing. Hence, the Torah doesn't have to tell me what takes place, or that there is a hereafter, because it's absolutely compelling that when the neshama is released from its physical prison, that it will live forever and will enjoy the blessings of a world in which there is no pain. So, and essentially what he's saying, what the Ramban is saying, the fact that the neshama, that the soul receives reward in the hereafter is self-evident. The Torah doesn't have to speak to it. The Ran and the Maharal and the Tiferes Yisrael makes a very interesting point. He said that the reason that the Torah avoids mention of the hereafter is because the Almighty knew that any faith could promise a hereafter, because you don't have to prove it. Any faith wants to say, come on, if you do this and this, then you'll have palaces and wine, women, and song in the next world. Great. Who can argue it? Who can disprove it? No faith would have the temerity, no faith would dare to say, if you do these things, then you're going to have all of the good things in this world, and you'll be free of all of the suffering of this world. There's only one being in the universe who can make that statement. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because being in complete control of what takes place on this world, the Almighty can say, look, Klal Yisrael, if you do what you're supposed to do, then I'm going to see to it it's going to rain at the right time. Your crops will be abundant. Your enemies will flee from before you. Whatever. You can observe the Shemitah, and I will see to it that on the sixth year you have enough produce for 3 years. Who can speak that way? No faith spoke that way. No faith dares to speak that way, because nobody can promise it. They know they can't deliver. That the only one who can deliver is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So in the Torah, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam put that which distinguished the Torah from other faith systems. Namely, do what I'm telling you, and I guarantee you that this world will reflect the rectitude of your good deeds. So he says that the Torah, therefore, speaks to us only about the material benefits and rewards of living according to Hashem's will, because that's really what distinguishes our Torah from all other faiths. As far as the reward for Olam Haba, he says something which is very similar to the Ramban. He says, he makes takes an additional point. He says, we see that there is prophecy. In other words, we see that the Almighty can communicate with a person, even though that person is in a very physical body. If that's the case, when a person is so impeded, where a person is surrounded by so much which ordinarily would obstruct that kind of relationship, how much more so when the person is liberated from that that physical barrier, that the Almighty would have a relationship with that neshama. So he says that the experience of prophecy is a direct proof of the eternity of the soul and the reward of the world to come. The Maharal in the Tiferes Yisrael, and also in his preface to the Gevuras Hashem, makes a number of other arguments. First one is, he makes the following statement. He says, prophecy, in the Tiferes prophecy, he says, prophecy can only speak in terms which are part of human experience. The world to come is beyond our ken. We have no terms. We have no images. We have no experience that would allow us any kind of handle, any kind of understanding of what this is about. He says, consequently, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Almighty, could not provide any prophetic medium which would speak of the world to come, because it is not accessible to prophecy. It is not accessible to human experience. There's a pasuk in Yeshaya which says, "Ayin le'gulas olakim zulascha." No eye has beheld this or can behold this. The only one who knows what this reward of the world to come is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it cannot be transmitted prophetically. And he says, since the Torah is a prophetic statement, and since scriptures are prophetic, that they must respond exclusively to something which is part of human experience, and this is not part of the human experience. So he says that the reward of the world to come cannot be treated other than by remes. In other words, we find all kinds of remozim, all kinds of clues, all kinds of things which imply in a very, very strong way that there is something in the world to come, and that we can only access it through chachma, through wisdom and understanding, from the perspective that chacham adif minavi, that the wise person stands higher than the prophet, because the prophet can only experience that which is part of their experience, whereas the wise person can access that which yields to the powers of human understanding and reasoning. He then proceeds to offer yet a second. He offers four or five different explanations. The second one is that if the Almighty were to put into the Torah that in response to our acts of choosing mitzvahs and renouncing averos, that there would be reward in the world to come, the implication would be that our world is complete, that our world has integrity only by virtue of the fact that we can appeal to the world to come. We need this statement of the world to come in order for our world to be navigable, in order for us to be able to live effectively. And he says that this world, when the Almighty created it, was not chasar. It was not imperfect. That it was self-sustaining, that it was intact. And our world must be self-providing. It must have its own integrity under its own terms. And that we should not have to, nor should the Torah have to appeal to something beyond this world, which is a world completely distinct of us, completely different than anything we can imagine, something which has its an identity all of its own, that should the Torah have to appeal to that other world, it would imply that this world, left on its own devices, is it comes up short. And he says that the Torah, which is a description of effectiveness in this world must be able to stand on its own merit. And therefore, there is no mention at all of the world to come, because the Torah is a Torah for this world, and this world can work even without appealing to the reward of the world beyond it. So even though there is a world beyond it, clearly, but that kind of description does not belong in the Torah. He goes on to make yet another point, which is a very intriguing point. He says as follows. If the Torah were to say that...
The moral is still speaking?
Yes, the moral is still speaking. That if we do what's right, then we are going to be rewarded in the hereafter. It is inviting us to serve a God, to serve the Almighty for sake of reward. And our sages implore us to serve the Almighty because the Almighty says so, and not because we want to be rewarded. So the Torah does not introduce reward in the hereafter so as not to compromise or to corrupt our service to Him. That then begs the question, so why does the Torah put in the physical rewards? To which the response would be either, according to Maimonides, that these are not a reward for mitzvahs at all. That when the Torah tells us that if you do the mitzvahs, that you will, and all of these blessings will come upon you, it's not as a reward for the mitzvah, rather than the Almighty saying, if you show your determination and commitment to follow my commandments, I'm going to make a world which will lend itself to your further pursuing with greater ease and in a very unobstructed way, that you'll be able to pursue the service of the Almighty without want, without pain, without need, without suffering, and so on. So it's not at all a reward. It's just simply a statement that if you do what's right, then I'm going to make it easy for you. And if you do what's wrong, I'm going to make it very hard for you. Simply as a statement that when we do things according to the Torah, that we then allow for the universe to function in a very healthy way, in much the same way that if we do the right things for our bodies, that our bodies will function properly. And that's what is simply descriptive. It has nothing, again, to do with reward or punishment. But it's telling us that if we live according to the blueprint of Torah, then the world will be a very well-oiled machine, and everything will flow properly. And conversely, if we violate Hashem's will, then we're throwing all kinds of gook into the machinery, and it begins to present all different kinds of forms of dysfunction. Whatever the case, the Maharal's assertion here is that the reason that we don't have the description of reward is because the Almighty doesn't want us to end up serving Almanas L'Kabal Pras for ulterior motives. Now, I think that there is something very, very powerful in this last point. I'd like to explain it and maybe amplify it a little bit. Let's take an example. There's a woman who is a very bright woman, a very compassionate woman, a very aesthetically gifted woman. In every which way, a woman of great intellectual, emotional, aesthetic, and physical beauty.
Chomer.
What?
Chomer.
So, and this woman has an immense fortune. And she is single. And she seeks companionship. She seeks a mate. But she wants the mate. She wants his companion to choose her for her merit, not for the money. She wants someone to choose the her personality, her character, her virtue. So, for her to state, okay, I want you to be my companion. I want you to be my intimate. I want you to seek a relationship with me, because you will then have access to my fortune. Is really to cheapen and to corrupt this relationship, because it means that someone is not choosing this woman for the woman, but choosing the fortune. And of necessity, there's no other way to get to the fortune. They're not really choosing the relationship; they're choosing the wealth. For Hashem to say to us, now, if you do this, I'm going to reward you hereafter, is to suggest that what we're really choosing is we want all of this, whatever it is, this bliss. We want all of this reward. When in reality, what we need to choose is the relationship. The way in which this thing turns is that if we were to choose Hashem because of the riches, because Hashem has this great fortune, we're not choosing Hashem at all. We're choosing ourselves. And if we're choosing ourselves, then the statement of our mitzvahs does not represent what we said it means. We said that a mitzvah affects us in the way in which it does. It brings us this excellence. It carries us towards this good only because the gist of every mitzvah is, Hashem, I yearn for a relationship with you. And if what we're choosing is the reward and the hereafter, then we're choosing, I want the money. Or we're choosing... the bottom line is that we're choosing ourselves rather than Hashem. Even if one could suggest the following, that Hashem would say, choose a relationship with me so that in me and through me you can access this good fortune. Right now Hashem is being even clearer. Hashem's like, no. I'm not telling you that there is all of this blessing there, because I'm afraid that you're then going to end up serving for an ulterior motive, in which case every mitzvah is going to, rather than really be an act of choosing Hashem, is really an act of idolatry. I can't afford to endanger, to risk this happening, because it'll end up just the very opposite of what I'm looking to have happen. So maybe Hashem will say, okay, I'm going to make it clear. I'm going to really hang it out there. Choose a relationship with me. I want you to choose me, as though to say, the woman is saying, you should choose my inner beauty. You should choose my character. You should choose all of these virtues that I have. Because if you choose those things, then you will really be able to access all of the other great things that come along with that that choice.
The analogy I have a little problem with, because when you're dealing with the woman, so her wealth is outside of her. When we're talking about keeping the mitzvah, it's ultimately the ultimate reward we're going to have is the relationship. So it's all intrinsic.
It's all intrinsic. If when we're doing whatever we're doing, has integrity. But if we're really, if it's really nothing more than an extension of self-indulgence, then we're not interested in Hashem. And it just becomes this peculiar paradox, where the moment that we act in self-service, that we no longer can we no longer have access to Hashem. So What might I argue? Okay, so Hashem is telling us, choose me so that in choosing me you can choose life. So let's go back to this mashal. A wife says to her husband, I want you to love me. I want you to care about me. I want you to respect me. And here's the way to show that you love me. Here's the way to show that you respect me. Here's the way to show that you care about me. If there's no other way, then all of this is perforce necessary. But if an individual can come to that understanding on their own, if they can understand that what this person requires is caring, loving, respect, then that becomes their active participation. In other words, they themselves have actively worked this thing through and understand that this is what needs to get done. The Almighty does not tell us that he wants us to express a yearning for the relationship, because if he has to tell us, then it lacks our choice. And in our understanding it, in our approaching it, rather than through prophecy, through our own chachma, by understanding that the underlying basis of all of Torah and mitzvahs is that we need to choose a relationship with him, that we need to yearn for him, that we need to want to have a relationship with him. It's that context that provides the ultimate context for that reward to take place. So the Torah does not describe the reward of this of the world to come, because the Torah wants us to work at understanding the fact that we must choose Hashem's sovereignty and a relationship with him, and not a relationship with Hashem's money or Hashem's reward. That then becomes the context of reward and punishment. That becomes the reason why Hashem does not talk about reward and punishment in the Torah, because that would undermine the quality and the excellence of the kind of relationship that we should arrive at by dint of our own industry, our own sensitivity. So, reward and punishment are very fundamental tenets of our faith. They are at once the kinds of things which we are directly responsible for. We are the creators of our own good. We are the creators of our own torture and torment. But in every event, the desired end of the kinds of things that are consistent with Torah is that we will have a personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we have to know that in every act of wrongdoing, that while we are responsible for all the things that come upon us, that Rabbeinu Shalom is never not involved, but that there are constant judgments that go on about the extent of Naisei Avain, the extent to which he bears our iniquity, the extent to which the Almighty will allow for the forces that we have created to turn upon us, and that the Almighty allows for in his compassion for us to do tshuva and to be able to dismantle the evil that we have done, such that we need not be subjected to this punishment. But that the hallmark of of our faith is the fact that we ourselves are the architects of our faith, that we define it and that we direct it, and that there is nothing which goes unnoticed and there shall be nothing which will go unacknowledged. And hopefully, if we understand what's at stake, that what's at stake is something which is eternal, we will have the sensitivity to deal with far greater seriousness and gravity with the decisions that we make.